Good morning. On today's programme, the violent deaths of women in Nigeria and the calls for action to stop the killings, and turning the spotlight on police brutality in India. But first we go to Australia. The number of Australian residents who were born in Ireland has passed 100,000, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It's a level not seen since 1921, when a very different Ireland was left behind by those who emigrated. In this modern phenomenon of emigration down under, what is drawing Irish people to Australia, and will they ever come home? Aisling Maloney has this report from Sydney.
The equivalent of the population of Limerick now resides in Australia. That's according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. Estimates show that as of June 2024, there are now over 103,000 Irish-born residents in Australia. You would have to go back to the 1921 Australian census to find a similar number, when 105,000 Irish-born residents lived here. Those arriving down under now in the 21st century are leaving a much different Ireland behind than those who left in 1921. But the attraction to the Great Southern Land is not much changed. Both 100 years ago and now, Irish people have come to Australia for opportunity. One sector that is in a constant boom in Australia is civil construction. Labourers, construction professionals and civil engineers are working on major infrastructure projects for cities with a population of more than the entire island of Ireland. For example, the upgrade to the Warringah Freeway, one of Sydney's most used roads, a major upgrade for the city's infrastructure, has Irish fingerprints all over it, in the boots on the ground and the contractors awarded the work. Australia's health and care economy is growing faster than it can train its citizens, and it has an expanding demand for qualified healthcare professionals in urban and rural areas. Figures from the Australian Health Practitioner Regulation Agency show that there has been a 70% increase in the number of doctors, nurses and other health practitioners like dentists and pharmacists since 2019, with over 6,400 Irish currently on the Australian register. Australia also participates in the Working Holiday Visa programme, which acts as a gateway for many to permanent residency and citizenship. Between the 80s and early 2000s, the number of Irish-born residents living in Australia was around 45 to 55,000. When the financial crash hit, this number grew rapidly. An extra 30,000 Irish arrived down under in the space of 4 years, peaking at 96,000 in 2013, and now over 100,000 for the first time in over 100 years. What's driving the increase, especially when Ireland has never been wealthier and more prosperous in overall terms? The US has turned its cold shoulder to immigrants. Costly and complicated visas have turned the American dream into the Australian or Canadian dream. Buying or renting a home has become unaffordable for the average Australian and the average Irish person too. But those who choose to stay down under point to other perks like better public services, transport, better work-life balance and the weather as factors that make up for it. There are few barriers for Irish people arriving in Australia. Most are white, known for having a good work ethic and can speak English. Of the 27 million people residing in Australia, 8.5 million were born overseas. The largest proportion, over 960,000, were born in England, followed by India at 916,000 and China at 700,000. While the topic of migration in Australia has heated up, the Irish have not been the subject of any targets so far. However, it remains to be seen whether the 103,000 Irish people now residing here marks a peak or the rising of a wave. This is Aisling Maloney from Sydney, Australia for World Report.
To Nigeria next. Since the beginning of this year, at least 20 women have died in Nigeria due to gender-based violence, according to activists and civil society organisations who've called for a state of emergency to be declared. Women's rights groups have blamed toxic online content and the country's weak legal protections. They say that many of the deaths are simply swept under the carpet, are treated as private family matters, or simply ignored. Polum David reports.
At the beginning of this year, the killing of Salome Adaidu, A 24-year-old young graduate caused mourning and outrage in Nigeria. Salome's tragic death made headlines after a man, Timilehin Ajayi, was arrested while allegedly trying to dispose the parts of her body. Ajayi, who claimed to be Salome's boyfriend, confessed to attacking her in his bathroom after accusing her of being unfaithful. While being interviewed by the press after his arrest, he said he had no regrets. The horror of Salome's death is not an isolated case. Stories like this are becoming heartbreakingly common across Nigeria. So why is this happening? Some blame weak laws and a lack of enforcement. Others point to deep-rooted cultural attitudes that treat women as inferior. The police often don't take these cases seriously, and perpetrators get away with their crimes. In the first quarter of 2025 alone, activists say more than 20 women have died due to gender-based violence. According to the Lagos-based Femicide Observatory, there have been 53 reported cases of women being murdered. They are often strangled, poisoned, or even stabbed by family and strangers. Women's rights group points fingers at toxic online content that glorifies violence against women and at Nigeria's weak legal protections, even though Nigeria passed the Violence Against Persons Prohibition Act in 2015, enforcement has been weak. 5 years ago, Nigeria, with support from the European Union and United Nations, launched a national database to track gender-based violence. The database had recorded nearly 28,000 cases, but fewer perpetrators have been prosecuted. The lack of sexual assault referral centers, financial constraints, and security risks further complicates the fight against gender-based violence. The United Nations said that globally, a woman is killed every 10 minutes. And in Nigeria, many of these murders are swept under the carpet, treated as private family matters, or simply ignored. Financial inequality and poor representation in politics make it even harder for women to be safe. Today, women make up almost half of Nigeria's population, but hold less than 10% of national political offices, meaning their voices are missing from decision-making tables. Leaders like Abbas Tajudeen, Nigeria's Speaker of the House of Representatives, have called for stronger partnerships between the parliament and law enforcement to combat the crisis. Nigeria's Women Affairs Minister, Iman Suleiman Ibrahim, also launched a new data system and promised a review of laws to better protect women. According to the minister, one in three Nigerian women aged between 15 and 49 has suffered physical or sexual violence. Wife of Nigeria's President Olusegun Tinubu has also spoken out, stressing the importance of education for girls as a way to break the cycle of abuse. She called for tougher punishment for perpetrators and greater support for survivors, particularly in rural areas where harmful practices like child marriage and female genital mutilation persist. Across Nigeria, campaigns against gender-based violence are growing. Some organizations like the National Council for Women's Societies, the Women Advocates and Research Documentation Center, and Women for Women International are demanding more funding, better laws, and real action. The fight is also expanding locally. New campaigns are being launched across all districts to raise awareness and support victims. Nigeria's President Bola Tinubu has pledged zero tolerance for violence under his administration for millions of Nigerian women. One can only hope that soon promises will turn into action and Nigerian women will be safe again. For World Report in Abuja, Nigeria, I am Polum David.
Finally, we go to India, where policemen in uniform are a common sight, but their policing methods are now under the spotlight following a scathing report which highlights their dependence on brute force for maintaining law and order. The report outlines how they resort to torture, target religious minorities and the underprivileged, and turn a blind eye to lynch mobs delivering instant justice on the streets. Sajida Momin has this report from India.
The police in India, the world's most populous country, have long been known to be a lawless force. And now, a new nationwide survey of the men in uniform by a respected research outfit has confirmed the worst. The respondent policemen have themselves admitted that they resort to torture and fear tactics on a massive scale, almost as a rule rather than an exception. They repose their faith in the stick rather than in any other method to maintain peace and uphold the law. Moreover, they harbour a deep bias against religious minorities and low-caste Hindus, who they perceive as pathological criminals. Hence, the underprivileged bear the brunt of police oppression and brutality and have practically no one to turn to because even the judiciary, one of the four pillars of democracy, develops cold feet when victims of police excesses approach the courts. The findings have triggered a fresh wave of outrage among human rights campaigners, and loud voices for curbing the extrajudicial measures are being heard, exerting pressure on Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government to make the guardians of law and order more humane and law-abiding. Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party took the reins of power in its hands in 2014 after evicting the Congress Party, led by Sonia Gandhi and Rahul Gandhi, which ruled India for two successive terms from 2004. Now in its third straight term, the BJP has been trying to build what it calls a new India by purging the world's largest democracy of a host of systemic failures, tarnishing its reputation. So in the light of the new findings, it will be interesting to see how the reformist BJP is going to police the police and ensure that law enforcers are not lawbreakers. The Status of Policing in India report for 2025, released last month, is the outcome of a joint exercise by the NGO Common Cause and the Centre for the Study of Developing Societies. Both outfits have acquired a formidable reputation over the years for exposing fault lines. The report is based on the findings of a survey conducted across 17 states. As many as 8,276 police personnel in both urban and rural areas across India were interviewed for compiling the report, which has, as anticipated, kicked up a storm. The prevalence and acceptance of the culture of physical torture and abuse behind the closed doors of police stations and secret interrogation centres is one of the most troubling highlights of the survey. A whopping 63% of policemen justified violence against suspects for what they brazenly called the greater good of society. Police personnel of all ranks, including those belonging to the elite Indian Police Service in leadership positions, found nothing wrong in resorting to third-degree methods in cases related to national security, such as terrorism or espionage. They felt that torture was equally justified in rape or murder cases, and while dealing with repeat offenders who are known as history sheeters in Indian police parlance. And the wide acceptance of torture has invariably resulted in shrugging off custodial deaths. Such deaths are not even properly documented or accounted for. The casual approach is evident from the divergence in custodial death figures compiled by the National Crime Records Bureau and the National Human Rights Commission year after year. Slapping or verbal abuse of suspects during questioning is pretty common, and many policemen have evidently developed an appetite for such coercive methods. Under Indian laws, an arrested person must be produced before a magistrate within 24 hours. He is also entitled to legal representation, but these safeguards are flouted with impunity. Vigilantism, too, is par for the course. The police approve of mobs meting out justice on the streets. They turn a blind eye to lynching and public executions. The survey also found that the police force is badly infected by the virus of sectarianism and majoritarianism. For instance, in the national capital, Delhi, 62% of policemen believe that Muslims are naturally inclined towards crime. These shocking prejudices and the utter lack of objectivity obviously make religious minorities sitting ducks before the police. Similarly, in Gujarat, an unacceptably high number of policemen displayed their animus against Dalits, or low-caste Hindus, and Adivasis, or tribes people. 68% of policemen in Gujarat said that Dalits are naturally inclined to commit crimes, while 56% felt the same about Adivasis, exposing how the police machinery targets the marginalized and the deprived. But according to Paramjit Singh, a seasoned human rights campaigner helming the People's Union for Democratic Rights, it is futile to blame the police alone, as the men in uniform simply mirror society at large. Singh says that in order to reform the police, it is necessary to change the psyche of Indians, which makes the Indian government's task really daunting and extremely challenging at this juncture. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Margaret Curley. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or on all podcast platforms. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.